Welcome to the Aerospace Advantage podcast. I'm your host, John Slickbaum, and today we are going to talk about China, the pacing threat, Wolf Warrior diplomacy, One Belt, One Road, island building, the Great Firewall, debt trap diplomacy. I could go on. And chances are you've heard about these concepts and ideas tied to China's rise. And let's be honest, there is a lot to track. By the time you understand the latest trend or news headline, another completely different China headline hits the cycle. Even more confusing is how China can seemingly have so many different things going on at once. And it's not just a military buildup. It also ties to aggressive foreign policy, political lockdowns at home, expansionist tendencies across the globe, and the list goes on and on. All of these factors make it really difficult to nail down China's core objectives. So that's the goal of today's episode. We are going to ask, what is China's intent? What do they want to accomplish with all of this activity? And what tactics are they using to achieve these aims? Today, we have Daniel Rice, Dr. Mulvaney of the China Aerospace Studies Institute, or CASI for short, and Ken Allen back with us to dive further into this topic. But first, I'd like to ask something of you, our listeners. If you like what you're hearing today, please throw us a like, rating, or comment from wherever you tune into the podcast. Your feedback is really important to us, and it helps give us a clear sight picture on what vectors we should continue on or explore in future episodes. I'd also like to give a quick shout out to Colonel Keith Ghost Butler, commander of the 509th Operations Group, home of the B2, who joined us on episode 18 of the podcast. Now, Ghost ran into our team at this year's Aerospace and Cyber Conference and gave us the idea for today's episode. If you want to find out more of what Ghost and the iconic B2 fleet are up to, you can find a link to his episode in today's show notes. Now, let's get back to the issue at hand. And to help me lay down the context and frame the discussion, I'd like to welcome back Mitchell Institute research analyst Daniel Rice. Dan, welcome back to the podcast.
Thanks, Slick.
Well, I got to tell you, Dan, this is a great episode to have you leading the charge and setting us up. And so, as you know, there are about a million different things that we're watching coming out of China, from foreign policy vectors to hardware and weaponry and domestic policy. How do you sift through all of this info to figure out what really matters?
That's a great question. And our listeners probably are aware the DoD just put out their annual China Military Power Report. And I can tell you just from reading it that it's really apparent that it's a lot of information to sort through. And it's really difficult to nail down exactly what is going on with China. So the way that I like to frame it is just first and foremost, the Chinese Communist Party, the CCP, their whole goal and the whole reason that they exist is to bring economic prosperity to the Chinese people. That's what the party was founded on, and that's what they've been pushing constantly. Remember that 6% annual growth? That's what they're living up to, or trying to live up to. And we can see by the most recent report that they're kind of missing the mark now. But that's really the driver behind almost everything that China does. So when you're looking at foreign policy and when you're looking at the military, it's all based on this idea of they need to secure any sort of economic opportunity to bring back to their domestic audience.
All right, Dan, I know you're our Chinese foreign policy expert, so I really need you to walk us through and talk a little bit about the importance of things like the Belt and Road Initiative, Chinese 5G infrastructure, and other general trends in Chinese foreign policy.
Yeah, so I just mentioned the economic goals, right? So when you're looking at these things, especially BRI, it's all based on developing international networks of infrastructure that will ultimately feed back to the Chinese people. And when you're looking at BRI projects, that's Belt and Road Initiative, a lot of the times, or almost every time, there is a domestic company that's linked to that international project, right? So you might have a company out in Xinjiang or one in Xizang, Tibet, as we know it, that has a stake in one of these projects. And the idea is with the Belt and Road to create that international string, literally, you know, the road, the Silk Road, that connects those foreign projects all together, ultimately funneling back to the Chinese populace at home. And the problem is that when you're looking at that kind of infrastructure, like Chinese 5G infrastructure abroad, or when you're looking at investments in ports like the Hambantota port or the port of Gwadar, things like that. It's largely for economic reasons that they invest in it, but they also are investing in it because it provides really great access, and that could be military access and it could be civilian access. And so there's actually this this new idea that China has been pushing forward, and it's called military-civil fusion. And that's the idea of really blending and blurring the lines between technology and infrastructure that can be used for civilian purposes and for military purposes. So when you're looking again at those ports, like the port of Gwadar, you have to ask yourself, you know, is the whole reason that they're purchasing this and have a 99-year lease on it, is it for military activity, is it for civilian activity? And there's really no good answer there. When you see like the 5G infrastructure as well, it gets a little scary because you don't want to have a Chinese company set up all of your network infrastructure just to find out that when push comes to shove, they're going to use it for military means.
Well, yeah, it's all really, really interesting. And you kind of touched on it a little bit, but I really want to understand just for the layman who's not a China expert, but why, you know, as the average American, do we care about what's going on in China halfway across the globe? And maybe even more specifically, if you can talk to, why does this really matter to our airmen and guardians?
Yeah, absolutely. And it is a hard question to answer, right? I don't think a farmer out in Iowa is really too interested in what China is doing. But, you know, in some ways he might be. And a good example of this is, well, it's no secret, really, that China's trying to shape the international order in a way that benefits them. And that's really cherry-picking different things that are different institutions that the Western world has developed, and really more broadly, the entire global order has built, and then altering them for their own means, right? So that farmer in Iowa, while he's enjoying exporting his corn all across the world, let's just say that China decides, I've got enough influence now in Southeast Asia to kind of push and bully those countries to no longer import U.S. corn. You know, a really good example is actually Taiwan, who imports a lot of U.S. Consumable goods like food. So if they can stop that or add a little bit of pressure onto the system that doesn't really allow us to pursue our economic interests, that's going to have real repercussions back home. And so when you're looking at things for like our military, right, our airmen and our guardians, why is it important for them? It's because part of the whole goal for really any country is to have the military might behind their interests abroad so that they can make things happen. It would be really, really, really difficult to try to create a regional trading organization or institution like the RCEP without really being able to flex some muscle. So one further thing here too is General Buzz Mosley on one of the last podcast episodes, he said something really, really smart. And he said, you know, war with China is not 100% certain, nor is it with Russia, really. But it is almost 100% guarantee that at some point in time, we will be having to fight the platforms that Russia or China produces because they sell them internationally. So again, for our airmen and guardians, you've got to be paying attention to what China is putting out. Otherwise, you know, let's say you get in a conflict somewhere else in the world, but they're flying Chinese platforms. You're going to need to know what those platforms are and what they're capable of doing if you're going to respond effectively.
Well, Dan, there's obviously a lot to unpack here. And what should we really be paying attention to?
Yeah. So the real things that we need to be watching are things that, quite frankly, we're not watching or we're not expecting. And I had a great conversation with Bradley Thayer. And the thing that he told me that really resonated with me was, you know, we're seeing all these breakthrough technologies that China's coming up with. And we're, you know, the whole community is saying like, oh my gosh, it's really, really exciting and kind of scary. You know, China just launched their FOBS, their fractional orbital bombardment system. Or the, you know, they created a 500 ton rocket booster or whatnot. It's technology that China has been investing in for the past 20 years, really, that we're finally seeing come that whole, you know, that whole acquisition cycle from creation to actual production. And now it's all coming online. So that's one of the big things that we got to watch out for, is that a lot of these technologies that we think are novel, China's been working on them for a long time, and we're just finally seeing them. So don't be surprised if some other sort of breakthrough technology or new capability comes across the newsfeed in the next year, you know, or, you know, shorter timeline, even the next few months. And another thing that we got to be looking out for, and I know it's the center of today's discussion, is those traditional areas that we've seen a lot of problems, or maybe not problems, but where there's potential for conflict and there's a lot of tension. And so I'm talking about the South China Sea, I'm talking about Taiwan, and I'm also talking about the Chinese military buildup writ large. You know, more capabilities, more forces deployed always is a red flag for us when we're looking at how we can best secure our national security objectives.
Dan, thanks for setting the stage for our discussion. And with that, I'd like to welcome today's guests. And first up, I'd like to welcome back Dr. Brendan Mulvaney, the director of Air University's China Aerospace Studies Institute. So, sir, welcome back.
Great. Thanks for having me. I look forward to today's discussion, and I think it's going to be really timely.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And I'd also like to welcome back Ken Allen, the former director of research at CASI. And he's also served a tour as a former assistant air attaché to China. So, Ken, welcome back.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here, and I'm looking forward to having this discussion today.
Well, I have to tell you, it's great to have both of you here, especially considering everything that's been in the headlines lately. So let's dive right into it. And we hear about it all the time. You know, China's very active in the South China Sea, setting up an area, you know, the anti-access area denial zone or A2AD zone to block access in the region. And I'd like to hear you talk a little bit about what's really going on here and why is China building this capability?
Well, their intention during conflict might be to block access to the region, although it specifically would be to block U.S. and our allies and partners, because the PRC really is dependent on trade and goods flowing through the South China Sea, not least of which is oil and raw materials during non-conflict times. The PRC is really looking to gain better situational awareness of what we call patterns of life in the South China Sea. So they want to understand who does what, when, and how, so that they can better plan for those future crises, you know, when it's not a time of conflict. So, of course, the PLA wants to be prepared if that time ever does come to keep U.S. and allies and partners out of the region so they can execute their own operations. And this is natural for any military to want. We just happen to have opposing goals on that score.
Yeah, no, I really appreciate that. And, you know, as I understand it, it's an artificial island in reef building that was capturing all the news and headlines a few years ago as part of the strategy. And for clarity's sake, this effort has not slowed down at all. So what exactly is it all about and how does this impact the region?
Well, it depends on what you mean by not slowed down at all. The illegal construction of artificial features in the South China Sea and after the 2016 UNCLOS tribunal ruling, none of them are islands. They're actually all called features. And that's a legal distinction for EEZ purposes. But actually, it's actually tapered off quite a bit over the last couple of years. There's been no substantial land that's been reclaimed or built at any of these outposts since 2015, 2016. Although before that, they did add about 3,000 acres of land to those areas. So I'd like to recommend that anyone interested in the details of what's going on in the South China Sea to check out the Asia Maritime Transparency Initiative, AMTI, from the Center for Strategic International Studies. They've done terrific work leveraging open source information and commercially available imagery to really describe what's going on there. But if you mean the development of features that they've already created and the emplacement of military offensive defensive equipment, then yeah, they are definitely still moving forward apace.
Well, Dr. Mulvaney, I appreciate bringing us up to speed to understand the why, but I'd like to talk about the what. And what do these islands look like and what sort of capabilities do they have and, you know, what may they have in the future?
Yeah, so we're talking radars, communications, equipment, and in some cases, actual aircraft and weapons are all there, right? They've developed them. They've created runways and bunkers and POL storage sites. And the PLA has equipped these bases with advanced anti-ship anti-aircraft missile systems, jamming equipment, and making them really some of the most capable land-based weapons deployed by anyone, any of the claimants in the South China Sea, right? And we have to keep in mind that China has disputes with many nations around the South China Sea, and this really is the most capable force that they're deploying. In addition to that, we've seen them deploy the KJ-200 anti-submarine warfare aircraft and the KJ-500 airborne early warning aircraft down to the South China Sea. And they regularly use these outposts to support naval and Coast Guard operations in addition to the air operations. So it's important to remind people that they're not just targeted toward that eye toward U.S. warships, but really toward disputes with its neighbors, the Philippines and Vietnam, et cetera, none of whom can stand up to these PRC deployments without outside support. So we certainly should expect further deployments of the PLA's advanced systems in support of their operations throughout these features throughout the South China Sea.
That's a really great segue into the next topic that I wanted to get to, and that's China's military buildup. I know we all have been tracking this closely. So, Dr. Mulvaney, we've seen the J-20 stealth fighter, the H-20 stealth bomber as new platforms, and we've seen existing platforms like the H-6 being equipped with hypersonic weapons. And that's just talking about air platforms. China's also been aggressively expanding its space portfolio with its Beidou GPS constellation, Tiangong space station, and has fielded a capable anti-satellite weapon and recently tested out a fractional orbit bombardment system. And as we know from the multiple cyber attacks, including the biggest breach of OPM records ever, that China is one of the biggest cyber threats out there. So can you talk to us a bit about the strategy here? Why is China focused on building these high-tech, information-centric systems?
Well, Xi Jinping has clearly said that he sees these, and he calls them new concept weapons, as the keys to the future. And he specifically talks about space as the new strategic high ground. But you're very right when you think about them in an information-related way. The PLA considers the information domain as a warfighting domain all on its own, and they put information and information systems to include cyber as well as space-based systems and EW, along with public opinion warfare and propaganda efforts, all under this information domain. So Xi Jinping and the rest of the Chinese Communist Party Central Military Commission believe that the key to future wars will be gaining and maintaining dominance in the information domain, and it's got to be at the outset of any conflict. So they continue to focus lots of time and effort and resources in developing these kinds of systems and capabilities and really operational tactics that will enable the PLA to strike early and decisively in the information domain. And many of these capabilities come at a relative cost advantage over systems that they aim to defeat. So I'm not really sure that we could call them asymmetric from a military perspective, but they are certainly asymmetric from a cost perspective, as well as the impact they'll have on what the Chinese see as the, quote, American way of war, which, of course, is what the PRC is trying to defeat.
Yeah, that's a really great point, Dr. Mulvaney. And that asymmetric advantage is it's one of the things that China's really been focused on for decades now, right? And so it's a new area for that. So beyond the obvious attempt to reach parity and exceed the U.S.'s military might, how do advanced technologies in the air, space, and cyber domains work to achieve China's strategic objectives?
Well, at this point, deterrence is the name of the game for all sides, really. The PRC is trying to deter Taiwan from moving farther away from the mainland politically. The U.S. is trying to deter the PRC from using force to invade and occupy Taiwan. The PLA is trying to deter the American forces from interfering in what they call, quote, internal matters. The PRC is trying to deter U.S. allies and partners from caring enough to even get involved. So it goes round and round. So all of these new advanced technologies, be they cyber, hypersonics, modern nuclear weapons, advanced dual-capable missiles, quantum communications, et cetera, all go first and foremost to trying to deter the other side. But if that deterrence should weaken or fail, the PLA has studied how the U.S. and our allies and partners fight and win wars. And they have and continue to develop weapons and tactics that are specifically aimed at defeating us and our capabilities, which the Chinese openly admit are still superior to their own. So we have to remember two items. One, China's still planning to play a home game. Taiwan's only 100 miles off the coast of the mainland, but it's something like more than 5,000 miles away from Hawaii. And second, the PRC would be more than happy to achieve its strategic objectives without ever using the PLA in kinetic action, right? So if they can obtain their goals through economic, diplomatic, and informational means. They're more than willing to do so. And that's why they continue to leverage their whole society approach against this problem.
Well, sir, you mentioned a few things, and I would like to ask you if you've seen any other areas where China's building up asymmetric novel technologies to push, you know, this strategy forward, or even from a personnel perspective, any insights on why China's picking these domains to focus on?
Well, they're focused a lot on the same things that we are, and the Russians are for that matter, right? So cyberspace, hypersonics, advanced nukes with MIRV and MARV capabilities. So we should expect to continue to see them use these things in ways that we wouldn't, simply because they're facing a different set of problems than we are, despite the source of those problems being the same, right? We have a huge logistics hurdle to overcome, how to get and maintain our forces and fuel and ammunition to the point of conflict. But once we're there, we have a big advantage. But getting there is our issue. CCP knows that, which is why they've developed this counter-intervention strategy to keep us out. And while they develop capabilities to invade and occupy Taiwan, which for the foreseeable future is really the only likely place that our forces would intentionally collide. So all their asymmetric and novel technologies are really geared toward deterring us from intervening, which complicates our plans if we wanted to intervene. So, for example, it doesn't really matter if the DF-21 could hit an aircraft carrier. Our Navy planners have to take that possibility into account, which then affects our plans. The same is true in the air and for our forward-facing options as well. So who knows if China is really willing to launch a strike on a third-party nation, namely Japan, but we have to plan like they will, and that has an impact on us, if you pardon the pun. But I think Ken could probably tell you about the changes to the personnel and how they're trying to get more and better education and educated people into their system.
Thank you. It's really interesting. Education in the PLA Air Force and the PLA as a whole, at one point in the late 1990s, there were 130-some officer academic institutions in China. And then Jiang Zemin cut those down and built what was called the National Defense Student Program, which is a rough equivalent to an ROTC program, in 118 civilian universities. Ironically, they've now abolished that as of last year because it wasn't working. The goal was to have 40% of all officers, the entire PLA, come from the National Defense Student Program. It didn't work. But what's interesting is I haven't really seen how they're going out and replacing that. The PLA Air Force has also shortened up its academic institutions. At one point, it had 15 flight colleges. Now they're down to 3. It had an airborne troop college. They've abolished that now as well. So they're trying to go and figure out how to do all this. They have an Air Force Aviation University that they created in 2004, and that provides 4 years of basic education and training for pilots. And then they graduate from there, get a bachelor's degree, go to a flight academy for 2 years, and they go to an operational unit for 1 year of transition training. So, but they start out with about 1,500 cadets in the pilot training. By the time they finish, actually get into their operational aircraft, they're down by over 50%. So each year, there's now roughly about 90 brigades in the PLA Air Force. Each one gets 6 to 7 new pilots every single year. So they start from scratch every year with no training at all, per se.
Dr. Mulvaney, I spoke a little earlier about China's international goals, and last time you were on the podcast, we talked about how China is really trying to bring that long-range set of capabilities to bear to facilitate overseas operations. How does China's military buildup play into their ambitions overseas, or is there really any interplay here? And let's skip the Taiwan aspect for now, because we will get to that in a little bit.
Sure. So General Secretary Xi Jinping is clearly articulating that he wants China to be at the center of the world stage and to be a leading world global power by 2049. So there's a lot that goes with that, and they have a long ways to go. But part of being a superpower is being able to conduct worldwide operations in support of your global interests. So despite decades of their non-interference doctrine, they'll need to go and be poised and ready to react to crises around the world. And until we invent teleportation, that means having forward-based forces. So while the PLA remains focused on China's key issues, namely territorial issues, Taiwan, the Senkaku, South China Sea, Tibet, et cetera, they do have an eye on those long-term goals and are developing platforms and capabilities that can support both the immediate needs as well as those long-term aspirations. Right now, we can expect to see aircraft carriers mostly in the Pacific and perhaps in the Indian, but eventually we expect to see them in the Atlantic and the Mediterranean. Air Forces, of course, are more of a challenge to permanently base and forward locations. But we should expect the PLA to look for any opportunities they can find. And probably the Middle East or Africa would be first on that list.
Well, Dr. Mulvaney, we mentioned earlier that China recently tested what appears to be a fractional orbital bombardment system, or FOBS. What does this technology mean for China and for the U.S. when it comes to deterrence and strategy?
So there's been a lot of hand-wringing about this for the last couple of weeks, but I thought that Dr. Laura Grigo from MIT did a great job kind of dispassionately talking about what exactly the Chinese accomplished and what it means in her event with the Foreign Policy Research Institute a couple of weeks ago. So yes, it was new. Yes, it was a step forward. But let's not forget that they already have weapons that travel at hypersonic speed, that are already MIRV and MARV capabilities, right? And if we're honest with ourselves, although we're getting better, missile defense is really, really hard. So even when we launch our own BMD against our own missiles, when we know what they're going to do, we don't succeed every time. So, of course, the Chinese and the Russians are looking for ways to keep ahead of our defensive systems, and we do the exact same. And like you said, it all comes back to the deterrence objective, right? So always keeping the adversary leery of his chances of succeed and worried about paying too high a price. So, yeah, it was definitely a big deal, and we should be paying attention to it. But it really wasn't a radical advance and didn't completely overturn our current capabilities. And, of course, we're working on the same things as well. So it absolutely was a step in that direction. But I don't know how much of a real impact it should have on our thinking about our deterrent capability.
Yeah, I appreciate that. So, Dr. Mulvaney, the FOBs and other space and cyber capabilities, they're all part of PLA's strategic support force, right? So could you give our audience a little bit of insight into exactly what this force is? I mean, it's not readily apparent by the name. I would like to think that's probably intentional on the PLA's part. But what does this strategic support force do, and how does having this force help China build out its military capabilities?
Yeah, you're right. The name is certainly fairly nebulous. And what it is it's a direct reflection of one of the things that we talked about earlier, and that's the information domain. So it combines their space, cyber, and EW forces all under one unified commander in a force that is co-equal bureaucratically with the Army and the Navy and the Air Force. And I like to remind people that everything except for the little satellite on the top of the really big rocket that goes to or from space, so including communication, imagery, intelligence, commands to those satellites, all of that takes place via electronic means, be it either spectrum or cyber. So the PLA sees all of this as part of the information domain. And in 2016, they reorganized most of these forces and capabilities under one roof, and they called that the Strategic Support Force, or the SSF. It reports directly to the CCP's Central Military Commission and is tasked with supporting the warfighting theater commands and national command authority. So we can expect to see the SSF continue to grow in military personnel, in civilian personnel, in funding, and in capabilities in the coming years. And it really is part and parcel to those new concept forces that General Secretary Xi Jinping is pursuing.
Yeah, thanks for shedding some light on that. So Taiwan is also a critical component to China's strategy. The CCP sees Taiwan's unification with China as a critical mission that stems from the very beginning of the PRC, right? Think back to the Civil War. So whether or not the CCP resorts to force to create this unification is still unclear, as Xi Jinping has made statements both for and against the forceful unification of Taiwan, and the U.S. has made clear that it won't stand by passively if China makes a move. Taiwan, on the other hand, understands that it's inevitably linked to mainland China, but demands the right to self-determination on the unification question. So the PLAAF has been making sorties into Taiwanese airspace consistently for the past few years and recently ramped up the frequency and types of aircraft that they have flown on these sorties. So, Dr. Mulvaney, I'd like to pull you into this discussion. What's really going on here? Why is China conducting these sorties?
Well, there's a lot of reasons for it, right? So one is that deterrence. Two is a messaging which is related to deterrence. But the PLA is accomplishing these missions for a couple reasons. And it relates directly to their Air Force and Naval forces. As they continue to expand their capabilities and their missions, this is one of the ways that they exercise them. A couple years ago, we saw them start to circumnavigate Taiwan. We saw them flying up the east coast of Japan, and this is just simply the next logical expansion to that. I will say that as far as the ATIS goes, there's a lot of different ways you can slice it. So part of Taiwan's ATIS actually goes over the mainland of China. So it's literally impossible for them to take off from certain bases and fly on over the mainland without entering the ATIS. What's really of concern are the ones toward the center line, as far as I would say. Most of these flights, although they have been much bigger packages, and like you point out, not only bigger in number, but bigger in their complex composition. But most of them have taken place kind of cutting the corner on that southwest corner of the ATIS, which is not nearly as threatened. But certainly the ones flying toward the center line, which is directly between the mainland and Taiwan, those are the ones that are more likely probing and are definitely stepping up kind of the gray zone operations, if you will.
Now, Ken, I want to bring you into this conversation. You're the go-to expert on sorties into the ATIS. Can you expand on this?
Yes. I think this is a really important issue. It was just brought up about how the Taiwan Air Force may be being overwhelmed with this and everything else. But almost nobody talks about the PLA Air Force and what's happening to them. What I want to do is sort of give you a little background and how did this all fits together. And a lot of this is covered in my book, 70 Years of the PLA Air Force. But the bottom line is this. What you have to do is take a look at how the PLA Air Force is organized. It used to be a division, regiment, a battalion, company-level organization. Starting in the early 2000s or 2010s, they've now gotten rid of all the fighter and fighter-bomber air division headquarters and upgraded the regiments to brigades. So it's now a brigade, battalion, company-level organization. And so the way that it works is let's say a brand new air brigade, a J-16 brigade, gets 10 airframes at the same time from the aircraft factory. Then, after X number of hours on those aircraft have to go all the way back to the aircraft factory for overhaul. It could be 4 years, 5 years. It all depends on the type of airframe. So the commander of that brigade gets those 10 airframes, and he starts doing the math. Okay, I'm going to do X number of sorties time-wise. Let's say each sortie is 1 hour, per se. I'm going to take X number of sorties, and for X number of sorties, I have to send those aircraft back to the aircraft factory. So now I look, and I have roughly 1.2 pilots per airframe. So those 10 airframes are put into what's called a flight group, a battalion-level flight group. Each flight group is divided into two flight squadrons, company-level flight squadron, of 5 airframes. And on any given day in a flight squadron, one of those airframes is in the back shop. So 4 airframes are out on the flight line ready to fly. So now I divide that up, and over the years, I have gathered every piece of information I could ever find on pilot flying hours. And the rough idea is this. Fighter pilots average roughly 12 hours per month, 150 hours per year. So you take those 12 hours per month, you divide that up, that's 1 hour roughly every 3 days, and then you take that hour, and then the PLA as a whole has what's called the Outline of Military Training and Evaluation, or OMTE. And under that, there are regulations, and each regulation for each type of airframe. And so a unit, say a brigade has a J-16 flight group. Each pilot in that flight group has to fly X number of what are called training subjects during the course of that month. So you take those 12 hours, you divide that up, you have takeoff and landing, you have navigation, you have MOMs, you have 1v1, 2v2. So each airframe also has a dedicated ground crew to that single airframe, anywhere from about 7 to 11 people. And there's a 2014 20-page article in the China Air Force magazine that talks about this aircraft maintenance. These maintenance personnel are working an 18-hour day for a single day of flying, from the time they get up in the morning till the time they go to bed. So you add maintenance into this, you add pilots. And so what I want to do is look at this. So altogether, since September of 2020, the PLA, as a whole, Naval Aviation Air Force, has flown 894 sorties towards Taiwan. Of those, only 8 have gone to the center line. The last one was back in May of 2021. Of those 894 sorties, they flew on 260 out of 400 days. If you divide those 260 days up, it's pretty much around about 30 days each day of the week, including Saturdays and Sundays. So that's one thing that they are doing. If you really break this down, so far, there have been 294 J-16 sorties. There are 2 brigades in the Eastern Theater Command Air Force, 1 brigade in the Southern Theater Command Air Force. Each of those brigades has 30 aircraft. That's a total of 90 aircraft. 1.2 pilots per airframe, that's 110 pilots. So you divide 110 pilots into 294 sorties, that's 3 sorties per pilot. So we're talking a whole year of J-16, each unit, one pilot basically is probably getting only 3 sorties over a course of, that's one sortie every 4 months. Now, let's say that the commander says, okay, you're going to get 10 sorties. Okay, I give one pilot 10 sorties, that's one per month. But that means that other pilots are not going to get those sorties. So now as the commander, I have to balance all this out. So that's the J-16 pilots. Now you look at the 86s. There are 5 regiments, air regiments of bombers in the Eastern and Southern Theater Command. They've only flown 53 sorties. That's 145 pilots into 53 sorties. Not every pilot's getting a sortie. That's only one pilot out of every 5 pilots that's even getting a sortie of the H-6s. So now you have to put all these things together. The J-16s, altogether there have been 50 days of sorties of J-16s. And of those, 18 have included the KJ-500, which is an airborne early warning and command aircraft. And who's in that KJ-500? One of the senior people from that J-16 unit. They get on that aircraft flight and they talk to their pilots in the air. That's how it works for the PL Air Force. In terms of formations, there were 19 formations of 2 airframes, 12 formations of 4 airframes. And again, think of this as flight squadron. Don't just think of numbers, think of flight squadron. However, just earlier this month, they had one day of 34 J-16s. So now you sort of break this down into flight squadrons and flight groups. Probably more than one unit flew that. So to me, when I'm looking at this, I actually think this is not a bad thing. We have probably learned more about how the PL Air Force does things in the last year than before. So we now look and say, okay, they're going to fly these sorties out there. Where do they come together? What's their formation look like? How long does it take? And again, if I'm only getting 12 hours a month as a J-16 pilot, and I'm flying a 2 to 3 hour sortie out into the southern part of the 80s, flying out, turning around, and going back, that means I only have 9 hours left for the whole rest of the month. And then my aircraft lands, and I go into maintenance for the next day for that airframe. So again, I think you have to put this in a larger perspective as well. How many pilots are actually getting these sorties out there, and what type of airframes, and what are they doing, and all that. Thank you.
Yeah, Ken, I really appreciate that perspective and how you've broken it down, especially with maintenance and how the pilots are getting their hours. Dr. Mulvaney, sir, being an airman, I can imagine that Taiwan having to scramble jets every time wears down both the jets and the airmen. And it's got to be quite difficult to consistently be on alert and ready for an attack at a moment's notice. So what does China want to achieve with conducting these sorties? Is it wearing down Taiwan, or are they testing boundaries of their airframes, or is it doing something else?
Yeah, no, you nailed it on the head. The PLA is the one planning these missions. They have the maintenance planned out. They have the planes ready. They have the pilots briefed to ready to train on tactics and techniques and switchology and communications, et cetera. And they get to see the reactions, where they're coming from, the timing and the mix, et cetera. So the PLA is gaining its time from these flights at the same time taxing the Taiwanese. They did the same thing to Japan 4 or 5 years ago. And like you said, pilots and aircraft that are sitting alert are not doing maintenance. They're not accomplishing much training. And again, it's part of the signaling, the deterrence issue. It's part of timing. It's part intelligence gathering. And it's part real-world operations against Taiwan and its forces. And at this point, literally, it is the PLA that is getting to do all the planning for these events.
Dr. Mulvaney, is there anything that you can see China doing within its military that's helping push the idea of China being a global force?
Yeah, so the first part is part of that internal propaganda message, right? So they continue to talk about how China's developing, how it's going to be a global player, how it has these worldwide aspirations and things like that. So the first is just inculcating the idea that at some point the PLA will likely be deployed overseas and far from home, right? And that's a fairly big change. You know, the base in Djibouti was their first overseas base, and that came after years and years of the anti-piracy patrols. So really the first and foremost is just an internal message to them. And then, as Ken kind of alluded to earlier, you know, the change in the makeup of the education. So you have to have, even on the enlisted side, right? So they try to get more and more people with college education, either partial education or actually people that have completed college to join the enlisted ranks, probably in the NCO ranks is preferable for them. But those are the kinds of people you're going to need to have forward deployed in some of these places as you work through a modern battlefield. So that's really kind of a two-part problem that they're facing is how do you go out and find places to go? How do you get the right people to do that? And how do you convince them that, hey, this is actually what you've signed up for? And I know that your father and your uncle and your grandfather all served in and around China. And although it may have been an austere place, you can still go home on the weekends or see your family or whatever. The whole being deployed, especially for long periods of time, is new to them. And so that's one of the big things that we see is they shift in the messaging to their own internal people.
Yeah, that's a fantastic response. All right, gentlemen. So today, we're talking about China's intent and tactics. And one of the big things that we've not talked about yet is non-military gray zone tactics. So what are some of the non-military ways that China is trying to achieve its global ambitions?
Well, there's been a ton of work on maritime gray zone operations, right? So Andrew Erickson and the team at what we like to call our big brother organization, CMSI, up in Newport, did some of the groundbreaking work on this and the role of the maritime militia. So what I think you're starting to see now is how the PLA is thinking about expanding air gray zone operations. And these are sorties in and around Taiwan that we talked about are one example. But we should expect to see increased use of UAVs and potentially flights in or around or even over, say, the Diaoyus. Potentially the use of commercial aircraft. It's a much harder decision to use force during an intercept against a civilian or commercial aircraft than a PLA aircraft. Cyber really is almost all gray zone operations. It's probing and understanding systems and linkages. And we see a ton of that coming from China, despite the promise that Xi Jinping made in the Rose Garden of the White House. And of course, the military and strategic implications of the PRC's economic and diplomatic efforts to gain support and to limit U.S. influence and potentially U.S. access to partners and places across the Indo-Pacific and Asia, specifically the Belt and Road, but there's been a lot of other diplomatic outreach to them. So it works for them. It's worked and is still working for Russia. And I don't see any reason for them to stop anytime soon, short of a clear and strong pushback. There was an article the other day which gave voice to some of the quiet discussions that they had around Washington that what happens if China tries their own Crimea event? And I don't think we really have a good response plan to that publicly.
All right. Well, gentlemen, I'd like to open the floor and give each of you a bit of time to discuss your number one thing that the U.S. can do to try to change the calculus or fight back in these different arenas.
Well, for me, number one would be get our own house in order, right? Steady budgets, even if they're smaller than a present or a planned, are key. Realistic expectations of our capacity to build and maintain leading edge forces. This requires hard decisions, and Congress and the DoD need to get on the same page, or we keep getting what we have been getting, which is a little of what each wants, and it doesn't actually provide us the capability to pursue our strategy. And finally, we need to know how to train for this kind of conflict. It's been a long time since we really trained our Air Force to work in a contested environment, and we have a hard time practicing and exercising like reality because, frankly, folks in Vegas don't like Nellis jamming the EM spectrum and turning off their cell phones, and the FAA frowns at us turning off GPS and shutting down radars. But that's what the reality we're going to face is. And so we need to find places and ways to train like we're going to fight. And finally, but probably most importantly in my mind, we need to continue to work with and do a better job with our allies and partners. They're key to our success, and when they are strong, we are all much stronger. And the PLA will face a task that's far more challenging, and one they're not likely to be capable of overcoming anytime in the foreseeable future.
I think one of the things that I would think the U.S. Air Force should be doing is I read the Air Force Daily Report every day, and there's always U.S. Air Force has this problem and this problem and this problem and this problem. The PLA Air Force is having a lot of the same problems. But what we're doing, there's no question at all, but the PLA Air Force is moving up that technological ladder. But at the same time, it has a lot of problems. I'm sitting here looking at a full-page article from June 29th of the Air Force, China Air Force newspaper. And just to give you a rough idea, they talk about aircraft accident problems, safety issues, and mental health problems because of training. And the political commissar is the one who gets in and says, you cannot fly today because you have this problem and this problem. So I think it's important to look at the hardware, and there's no question about it. Hardware is really, really important. But now, who's the pilot in that cockpit? What are they doing? How do they move up their career path? What kinds of training do they do? How good are they? Who's telling them to do what? And that They're starting to do the Golden Helmet competition back in 2011. Each year's a step-by-step-by-step process. They're getting better, but they're still not at a 10. And I think we need to balance that out. I asked once a friend of mine to ask the squadron commander in the U.S. Air Force, what do you think about on a daily basis? And personnel issues is one of the top things. But nobody talks about the personnel issues in the PL Air Force. And we've got to balance that out along with the hardware. That's my opinion.
All right. Well, gentlemen, I'd like to thank both of you for being here today. It was really an excellent discussion, and I look forward to having you both back on the Aerospace Advantage in future episodes.
Thanks. I appreciate the opportunity, and definitely look forward to the next time, because I don't think China is going away anytime soon.
Thank you. I really appreciate having the opportunity to do this.
Thanks, Slick.
With that, I'd like to extend a big thank you to you, our listeners, for your continued support and for tuning into today's show. If you like what you've heard today, don't forget to hammer down on that like button and follow or subscribe to the Aerospace Advantage. You can also leave a comment for us to let us know what you think about our show or areas you would like to hear more about. As always, you can join in on the conversation by following the Mitchell Institute on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, or LinkedIn, and you can always find us at mitchellaerospacepower.org. Until next time, this is John Slickbaum. Stay safe and check six.